Hello, I'm Tony Ryan in Adelaide, South Australia, with a series of interviews with contributors to New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. It's available online, www.newmalestudies.com. Misandry and emptiness, masculine identity in a toxic cultural environment, is the challenging title of an article in this first edition of New Male Studies and International Journal. In this conversation around misandry and emptiness, I spoke via Skype in December 2011 to the authors Dr. Catherine Young, Professor Emerita at the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and Dr. Paul Nathanson, also from the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University in Montreal. Catherine Young, what is meant by misandry?
Misandry is really the counterpart of misogyny. If misogyny is the contempt or hatred of women, misandry then is the hatred or contempt of men.
We see so much on our television screens and in film that portrays men as, well, a problem.
Well, to be more specific, it portrays men as either inadequate or evil, or both.
Our first book, called Spreading Misandry, did look at misandry in popular culture, and it looked at it through box office hits of films, through jokes, through every kind of media. And that's where we came up with this pattern of inadequate evil. Or honorary women, that was the third category. And that meant a male feminist who had turned his back on other men and the problems that men face today.
Or it could also mean a minority man. They get a sort of free pass.
Because of the alliance with feminism.
What does this say about images of masculinity?
The big problem with masculinity is that it's an empty word because there is no there's no content anymore. At the very best, it's a kind of innocuous incompetence, but it doesn't signify anything as it once did of, let's say, a way of life that contributes in some powerful way to the community. The family or the community.
I mean, traditionally, masculinity was the cultural counterpart in some way of biology. It was related to male bodies, to male strength, to male mobility, to male power in some ways. It wasn't the same as biology, but it was that cultural component that did relate to other people, and it related to society in some kind of positive way. And now the cultural aspect has been stripped away so that, yes, there's still male bodies around, but what do they mean for young men? How do they help men to establish their place in the world as men, qua men,
yeah,
as a group?
I think another way of saying this is that masculinity no longer is about manhood. It's about some age range, a kind of twilight zone between boyhood and what was once manhood, but since there is no definition of manhood anymore, they sort of remain at this level of the frat jokes, people who have no jobs, no interests, no skills, no social skills. And very often on TV sitcoms, for example, there are men in their 30s who are married to women who are very competent and very actually middle class, whereas the men are incompetent, and very often their personalities are surrounded with stereotypes of working class or lower class men. So there's the women are educated, they're sophisticated, the men are relatively uneducated, very unsophisticated, childish, incompetent.
Or sometimes we see the pattern of machismo. In other words, if there's a emptiness underneath, then there is a return to some of these stereotypes of machismo. And that is probably a way that there for compensation with the loss of male identity. So you do see that pattern as well.
It says something about our society that we accept this and we laugh at the bumbling male.
Yes, it used to be that many different groups would come in for some kind of humor, some kind of even attack on their group, but done in a humorous fashion. And that, in a sense, was okay, because if everybody got had jokes about them, it was an equal opportunity, so to speak. But now all of that is politically incorrect, except men. They're the one group that's left to be ridiculed, and not people won't be embarrassed by ridiculing them.
You mentioned the word emptiness. Could you talk about that a little more in the context of men and identity?
Well, emptiness really refers to the fact that there is no more meaning to manhood. It's an empty concept at this point. And there are several reasons for that. One of them is it came about unwittingly as a byproduct of egalitarianism and egalitarian feminism in particular. You know, the goal of egalitarian feminism was to ensure that men and women were treated equally by the law. And gradually that came to mean that men and women would be, by and large, the same. But if men and women are the same, then that means that men no longer have any distinctive, necessary contribution to make to society as men. And therefore, they can no longer have a healthy identity. Now, there was an imbalance, however, because it didn't work the other way around. Because women, after you've sort of subtracted all the cultural stereotypes, you're still left with the ability to give birth. And so there was a kind of asymmetry. Men could have nothing whatever to contribute to society, but women could still contribute at least that.
I think when you look at this historically, the large historical pattern for male identity was provider, protector, progenitor. But now, are men providers? Well, some are, but very often women provide for themselves, or the state helps women so that they don't need men as providers. So provider is out. Protector, it's a bit of the same thing, that women either protect themselves or there are institutions of the state that do the protection. But for individual male identities, or even male identities as a group, firefighters are both men and women now. Police forces are both men and women. So you can't single out being a protector as distinctive of male identity. And progenitor was the third great one, being a father. But now, as we'll probably talk about soon, with new forms of family and marriage, progenitor does not have to be, it still has to be male sperm, but the idea of fatherhood does not have to be part of that. So all of those three great identities, which had many, many different cultural variations, no longer play into this definition of masculinity and therefore healthy manhood.
So how do men and boys respond to this emptiness?
Well, some of them give up, which is to say there's a suicide rate that is many times that of young women. Others drop out. They drop out of school faster, many more of them than women drop out of school, either at college level or even high school level. Some of them, however, act up, which is to say, they say in effect, if we can't have a positive identity, then we'll have a negative identity, because even that's better than no identity at all. These are not exactly healthy ways of responding to this problem.
And I think there are two more here. And one is some men become a male feminist, and they turn their back on men, and they further the cause of women, but often at the expense of men. And therefore, they don't have to deal with this emptiness, because in a sense, they're in the protector role still.
Yes, but they also have the problem, whether they recognize it or not, of self-hatred, because if you buy into at least the ideologically feminist notion of men as the eternal enemy of women and the source of all suffering, the only way, I mean, by the logic is that you have to hate something in yourself. So that, too, is not exactly a healthy way of dealing with this problem.
And there's one last argument here, is a lot of men will say, I don't need an identity as a man because I have an individual identity. I'm a professor, a lawyer, a doctor, a contractor, and so forth. So who needs a group identity? But of course, women always will have a group identity to the extent that they are the ones that can give birth to children and that they can add all kinds of culture onto that. In the past, a lot of that culture was denied, but now they have the best of both worlds, so to speak.
And they've spent the past 40 years precisely on the project of redefining their own cultural identity as a group. And because part of that process of defining their identity was identifying men as the other, you know, having gone through that process, men don't really have a choice but to deal with collective identity. Women threw down the gauntlet about collective identity.
What does all this say to young boys these days?
Well, first, I think they've got to become aware, self-conscious about misandry, just as women 40 years ago had to become self-conscious about misogyny and then start to address it. So young boys need to have this consciousness raising that there is serious misandry and to take it on, to critique it. It's a bit parallel to the misogyny issue.
Well, I think that many of them are aware of it. You can see it in the response to jokes, for example. They might laugh, but with embarrassment, and there's a kind of an awkwardness. I think they're aware of it, but they don't yet have the courage to make an issue of it, to say this is not an acceptable joke or an acceptable portrayal in film.
But to take on this issue means you've got to be pretty well educated about it, too. It's very hard to have a gut reaction that this is wrong, that should be expressed. But always then you're going to get a return challenge. Well, you know, men did this and men did that. And then you need to really know what new male studies would be about and what the research is that can challenge a lot of those stereotypes.
And you also have to be aware, and this is very difficult for most people, you need to be aware that there is a moral problem here. And that's a level of abstraction that most people find difficult to get to. But when we hear, as we do over and over again, the idea that, okay, well, men did bad things to women for thousands of years, now it's the turn of women to do bad things to men. Now that, you see, is a fundamental rejection of the most basic moral principle. That's turning revenge into some notion of justice. But revenge is not justice. And now that's an abstract idea, and it's hard to talk to people about that because it feels good to get revenge, let's face it. But that still doesn't make it morally acceptable. But that's hard to talk about.
In your article, you write about this psychological twilight zone and the rise of feminism and the absence of anything even remotely like coming of age. Could you comment on that?
Coming of age is certainly as a man is a pretty well universal feature of human societies. And what it meant originally and until very recently was that boys would acquire the knowledge that they would need as men to serve society. Now, that the process of learning would culminate in some, very often it would take place beyond the boundary of society, in maybe in a wilderness or something, and there would be a ceremony that would welcome them back into the community, not as boys, but in their new status as men, and able to protect and defend the community. Now, we have nothing remotely like that now. First of all, there is no ritual that even pretends to be coming of age, except in some religious communities. Well, Jews have the bar mitzvah, but then, of course, the bar mitzvah boy is 13 years old and therefore not really able to come of age except in some ritual sense. In some Christian communities, there's confirmation, but once again, that's restricted to a small segment of society. So what substitutes for these coming-of-age ceremonies are things like, at one time, it might have been, getting a driver's license or graduation from high school, which are both things that both boys and girls do, and therefore not applicable as coming-of-age as a man in particular. So there really is nothing, there's no equivalent now. When we hear about coming of age in the movies, which we often do, it refers to acquiring some kind of sexual knowledge, for example. But that has nothing to do with entering society as a responsible adult. So coming of age, even the words coming of age have been very attenuated.
Again, I refer to your article, and you write, the academic world is changing, albeit at a glacial pace, when it comes to the study of men and boys. What is changing, and why is it happening at this time?
Well, first of all, we're getting some good research done. To give courses, to mentor, to teach means that you need resources, and to counter stereotypes, you need resources. So gradually we're seeing the number of books on men increase. Sometimes there are historical ones that talk about different understandings of masculinity in different cultures. Sometimes there are, you know, about coming of age rituals. Sometimes they're about men in Victorian England, men in the lodges in America. So very good monographs are coming online, and that provides a resource for further research, but also for teaching. Now, Paul and I have looked at universities that give courses on gender, and we found that for a long time, gender really meant women's studies, or that has been transformed a bit into women and gay studies, for example. But we were looking at, well, is there any discussion of straight men, of the issues about identity that we find, or even there's a bit more on the historical side of things. But there was very, very little in the courses that would be devoted to men under the rubric of gender. Then there would be little sections of courses occasionally, but I think it's only now that there's, and we haven't seen too much of it yet, that there's being a push to develop better men's studies courses in universities. People who try to develop them, they often face a wall of protests.
There's no men's studies program on this continent that offers a graduate program. There are some college-level men's studies programs, some of which are basically feminist-oriented courses. They teach men through the lens of feminism. So we're not there yet. A few years ago, I spoke to somebody about the possibility of a course on men's studies, a department of men's studies, and he told me that he had investigated at his university in the States, and it was the effort was stymied because one of his colleagues said that studying men would be like studying Nazis. It would be like a department of Nazi studies. So that gives you some idea of the background here.
I mean, there's also now new journals coming online. Even Paul and I, we've been working on this topic for 25 years now, and it was very hard to get published because there's a reaction that men have all the power. Why do we need to say anything more about that? It was hard to do that, hard to get into journals that often, you know, had an editorial board that did not like this kind of research, that in some way it would detract from studies about women and advances for women. So we see some new journals developing now, and that it should help to move this forward.
The most obvious example, of course, being New Male Studies.
Indeed.
I'm going to change the subject for a minute because I just heard something interesting. You know, the idea that men have all the power is a pervasive idea, and I think even many men believe it. The problem is that the men who have all this power are basically what we would call alpha males. You know, there is a minority of men who have a lot of power, but most men are not alpha males by definition. That's a fact that people are very reluctant even to acknowledge.
Do men and men as fathers have a future?
Well, we have to hope that men have a future, because otherwise we're going to be looking at parthenogenesis or something equally bleak. So men are here. Now, the issue is whether we want healthy men here you know, men that are part of society, men that are appreciated and valued and make a contribution. And that's where, if we don't think about this quite deeply and start to, you know, develop the positive cultures that support that kind of good male identity, we're going to have men around, but extremely antisocial men or suicidal men that take the negativity back onto themselves.
I mean, one way of looking at this is to simply ask women, you know, do women want their sons to continue falling behind girls in school? Do they want their sons to be at greater risk of committing suicide or being killed or being imprisoned?
Or becoming so machismo that they're not somebody you want to be around. That's another possibility.
And in fact, some of the people who were at the earliest stage of our work, some of the people who were most interested were in fact mothers who had sons, and they were worried about their sons.
Misandry and Emptiness, Masculine Identity in a Toxic Cultural Environment, is the title of an article by Dr. Catherine Young, Professor Emerita at the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University, Montreal, Canada, and Dr. Paul Nathanson, also from the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill University in Montreal. The full article is published in New Male Studies, Volume 1, Issue 1, January 2012. It's available online, www.newmalestudies.com. That's newmalestudies.com. In Adelaide, South Australia, I'm Tony Ryan.